Welcome to Law in the Family, a production of the Pennsylvania Bar Association Family Law Section, providing insights for lawyers about the practice of family law in Pennsylvania. The information shared during this podcast is for general information purposes only. Nothing in this podcast should be taken as legal advice for any individual case or situation. This information is not intended to create, and receipt or listening does not constitute an attorney-client relationship. The opinions expressed are those of the hosts and the podcast guests, and don't necessarily represent those of the Pennsylvania Bar Association.
Welcome to Law in the Family, where we discuss issues and topics related to the practice of family law in Pennsylvania. I'm Aaron Weems, a family law attorney in Fox Rothschild's Bluebell, Montgomery County office. Today, my guest is Peter Bort. Peter is a family law attorney and collaborative divorce specialist based in Malvern, Chester County. And Peter's here today to talk about the facts and fictions of collaborative divorce and help us better understand that process. Peter, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you, Aaron. It's so great to be with you this morning.
So, Peter, for anyone that doesn't know you, maybe you could give us a little bit of background about your career and how you came to develop as a collaborative divorce specialist.
Well, I graduated Georgetown University Law Center in 1984 and pretty quickly found my way into the family law niche. It was probably the only area of law I was any good at. I have litigated thousands of cases in our southeastern Pennsylvania area, but I haven't been a litigator since 2017. And that was preceded by me becoming a mediator and having mediated thousands of family law cases since 1994, scores of what we call collaborative divorce cases since 2010. And I was not the best litigator and I wasn't the worst litigator. And honestly, I think my approach to sharing my gifts into the world, I've really found my niche with the mediation and the collaborative practice. In addition, I've been a mindfulness meditator for almost 40 years, and that's a daily practice. And it certainly can assist with the approach to or paradigm shift, which I'll describe as it relates to the collaborative law cases.
So maybe just from the beginning, you can talk a little bit about the concept of collaborative divorce, because I'll just speak for myself, in which I heard the terms and we've often had some information about it or some discussions about it within sort of the family law bar. But I will be honest, in which I kind of just thought it was a synonym for mediation. It wasn't necessarily that distinctive from that process. Could you tell us a little bit about how it differentiates itself from a standard mediation?
Yes. So first of all, what collaborative law is not, is it's not on my website. It says I'm a collaborative attorney. Okay. So it's an actual technology that we get trained in, and it is interdisciplinary. What makes it interdisciplinary is that we have the ability to have a team serve a family that consists of a divorce coach who's trained to handle the emotional content of communication between the parties and the team. Each party has their own legal advocate, attorney, who's trained in the collaborative process. And we often use a financial neutral, who is often a CPA and can generate different economic scenarios, can capture scenarios as it relates to premarital and postmarital property, can value family businesses. So mediation, how it differs is that neither party in the process has an advocate, a legal advocate. So when I'm in mediation, as the mediator, I'm a neutral. So I can't really give legal advice to either party. I can only give, quote unquote, legal information. So legal advice would come from an advocate for them who would take all the facts, all the law and legal norms, apply them to that individual situation and say, hey, here's your best outcome. Here's like the least outcome you could expect. It'll be somewhere in the middle. A mediation, think of the spouse that doesn't feel very comfortable in the financial sphere, and they're about to enter into the most important financial transaction of their life, and they're doing it without an advocate, and they're maybe doing it without any expert financial advice. And the opposite of that is collaborative, where there's a team focused on that, and the team develops, well, what are your goals and interests? And then what we do is we develop that each one has a list of their individual goals and interests, and then we match them up, and it's a good fit for the collaborative team process if they have a lot of overlap in their goals. In other words, we both want this, we both want that. I want this, I want that, and there's a lot of overlap. And so in 2018, Pennsylvania adopted the Collaborative Law Act, Act 55 of 2018. And what it did is it carved out a special area of practice within the Pennsylvania legal framework to have a collaborative divorce case. And the real key that distinguishes collaborative divorce as a technology from two lawyers saying we're going to be collaborative together is a participation agreement signed by everyone involved, the two parties, any team members, and it contains something called a disqualification clause. And what that clause says is that this group that's assembled, the two attorneys, the two clients, divorce coach, financial, neutral, if either party or both parties no longer want to be in the process and want to go to court, they must start over with different lawyers, and the neutrals, the divorce coach and the financial neutral, cannot be called to testify, and their work product cannot be used in the subsequent litigation. Now, it sounds like that's setting up a scenario for the family to lose economically. It's not, because the disqualification clause creates skin in the game for everyone to stay in the process. My personal experience is only 3% of the cases I've had where we sign the participation agreement, only 3% fall out of bed. And I often have the concern when people who are not part of this collaborative community say, well, I can't sign that, and I can't let my client sign that because then they'll lose me as their attorney. And I'm essentially saying, look, why don't you have trust in yourself that you can make this work? This process will work. And honestly, I have done many cases with colleagues who don't have that much experience in the collaborative process. And it can be like you've got, you know, kind of a lower octane gas in the tank and the motor runs a little rough, but it's still so much smoother than the litigated scenario. So the perfect family for collaborative is one where there is not threatening or violent behavior by either party, and where there is the willingness to have a full disclosure of the finances and anything else that's relevant. And so we can pivot by emphasizing the goals and interests of the individual parties. We can pivot the family to a high functioning post-divorce operation, so that values the kids, that values things like showing up at graduations, weddings, baptisms, christenings going forward. And my God, from the, you know, almost 15 years of doing this, I have so many examples of that, where families maintain this kind of conscious uncoupling, this aware, awake, in a good sense, approach to making their new family. So yeah, mediation is great. Like, let's say that it's a short-term divorce. There's no kids. There's not a whole lot of stuff accumulated during marital coverture. And these people just want to get on with their lives without spending a lot of money on litigators, or even spending a lot of money on the back and forth four-way communication of two lawyers, two clients who are not really coming together in the same space to form an agreement. A mediation is great for that. One of the nice things about the collaborative process is it's very structured, in that once we sign that participation agreement, we as professionals are having meetings apart from our clients. We're having meetings with our clients alone. And we are, before we have a full team meeting, we circulate an agenda. One of the things that my clients have expressed over the years consistently is that they are taken by surprise. They have a lot of anxiety about what's going to happen in a particular court meeting setting. Well, we take a lot of that away because we have an agenda. So they know what's going to show up in the meeting to be discussed. And we pretty much keep to the agenda. The agenda becomes the minutes of the meeting, right? What's captured that took place in the meeting, any homework that's generated as a result of the meeting is captured in a written form, agreed to. We don't leave the first meeting without scheduling the second meeting so that we keep the process moving forward. One of the dynamics that can happen in mediation is that one spouse can be more motivated toward conclusion and the other less. And the mediator's not powerless, but there's not much a mediator can do to say, look, you have to show up, you know, for the next schedule. We have to schedule the next, you know, it can be real tough to do that. Whereas here you've got a divorce coach who's fully aware of the emotional dynamic and can intervene along with the other team members to keep a case going. Another great thing about it is what takes place in a collaborative divorce, just like with a mediation, is entirely private. And so if you're discussing the finances of a family business or some things are going on that you wouldn't want discussed in an open tribunal, it's all, everybody's sworn to confidentiality and the privilege attaches unless there's threatening or violent behavior or unless there is criminal behavior. So everyone is contained in an envelope of privacy with the process. As a lawyer, here's one of the advantages. I have no receivables from these cases. Okay. People are happy to pay their bills. One of the topics we discuss sometimes in meetings is how do we make sure everybody, all the professionals get paid? How do we have liquidity for that? And it's open, transparent communication. So isn't that refreshing? Isn't it refreshing that you're not receiving a phone call from a judge's chambers that the judge wants you on an emergency petition call tomorrow morning and you're on vacation with your family? That doesn't go on. You manage your calendar. You don't have receivables outstanding. It's lower stress because let's face it, when I went to law school, I wasn't trained how to handle the emotional content of my clients' communications with me and with their spouse. But the divorce coach is. The divorce coach has a mental health background. So now somebody who's really skilled at handling that level of communication is handling it, not me. And then I'm not really a numbers guy. Like I can fumble my way through a spreadsheet, but when I have a financial neutral running different scenarios, like let's say I have the financially dependent spouse, and instead of me just kind of BSing them and saying, well, a 55-45 with alimony for 1 year for every 3 years of marriage, you'll be fine. Instead of BSing my client about that, the financial neutral can model, okay, here are the assumptions about what you'll be earning. Here are the assumptions about what you'll be receiving from your spouse and in the marital estate. And it's a financial planning piece that the financial neutral can do, model different scenarios. And same for the financially superior spouse. They'll have a model too to show, hey, you're going to be fine. You can actually give a little bit more over here and you'll be fine. The other thing is that we can have win-win. So let's say that there's a family business and we have the next generation and we've talked about how to have a succession, but nothing's been done. And so what if the son is buying the dad's business? And what if the son is actually paying that payment to his mother? Essentially, the alimony is being paid by the purchase of the business. So all kinds of very creative things can be done in this space.
So what I'm really hearing in a lot of this is that you are looking for a particular type of clientele that is really going to be open to this type of process. And you talked a little bit about it in the beginning about low conflict or no conflict type of cases. Tell me a little bit about how it is that the screening process that goes in for these cases, and also how you typically see that these parties find their way into collaborative divorce situations, whether it's by the attorneys that they consult with or work with, or is there some other type of referral process that finds their way in there? And then from your perspective, how do you start to go through there and how do you evaluate whether these people will be ripe for it? Because unlike mediation, which I think one of the risks, and I don't want to be unfair to mediators, but one of the risks is that people can just parachute out of it if they don't like the direction it's going. There's nothing that's necessarily going to lock them into the process. This sounds like it's a little tighter and it's a little bit more difficult to submarine the process if you don't like it because of all these other apparatus that are involved that might help try to pull you away from that, whether it's the divorce coach, whether it's the financial neutral that might be able to speak to a concern that they have financially. So why don't you kind of talk a little bit about the client base that you have?
Yeah. So first of all, to assess whether a family is a good fit for collaborative is something we give them questions to answer that are in the form of a self-assessment. And then, you know, if it's a really low score, meaning, you know, that they're not as fitted for the process, I personally don't want the case. I have colleagues that are a little more daring about the level of conflict and low score cases that they'll take, but I like an easy life. So I'm less likely to take those. Although I have a couple shining examples where that succeeded. And essentially, it's because I really trusted who the other team members were. So there's an assessment, and that was part of the work done by the folks that founded this collaborative process is the assessment. And then how the clients find us. Imagine this, Aaron. Maybe you have a great pipeline for mental health and financial professionals to bring you cases. Maybe they originate a lot of your cases. But if not, imagine that you can be asked to be part of a collaborative team and the family is originated because of the mental health professional or because of the financial neutral. It actually, for me, it opened a whole nother stream of origination of cases. So that's how we find each other. Now, we have a group, an interdisciplinary group in the southeastern Pennsylvania area. There's one in the west side of the state. There's one to the north central part of the state. There's a few in New Jersey. And these are collaborative practice groups. They contain lawyers. They contain divorce coaches. They contain financial neutrals. As ancillary members, we'll have realtors, mortgage brokers, clutter specialists, you know, things like that. And so this practice group does not share revenue. So we're not in violation of the ethical code of Pennsylvania. So it's not a company. It's an affiliation of professionals. We need to meet standards of training, of continuing education. And here's the most important thing. If you're going to stay in the group and be successful, you have to make a paradigm shift. The paradigm shift I made is I was trained as a litigator. And it's kind of like if I have one of those pictures in front of me that is in two dimensions, and then if I look at it long enough, I see the third dimension of it. I see it as three-dimensional. That's the visual metaphor of what has to happen. I have to have a paradigm shift from the narrow focus of the tough as nails, get every inch of the battlefield or my troops approach to family law. And I have to shift over to, I see your goals and interests. I see what's important to you. I value your client. I value you. So it's a completely different paradigm. It's a paradigm where everyone is coming into a team focus and a team function for the sole purpose of getting this family to transact, transform, get to the other side of their new, how they work together as co-parents or formerly married people.
So we talked a little bit about some of the networks and the professionals. So we're talking about bringing in basically anyone that's going to do the job that's necessary for the case. So let's say we have pensions, we have ERISA-based plans. You bring in financial advisor with ERISA experience, I would assume. Same with custody and support, people that can determine net incomes for support. How do you involve professionals when custody is involved?
Yeah, so custody, we have something called a child specialist. And I'll be open with you and tell you I've never had a case with a child specialist. Because by definition, that's probably a higher conflict case because mom and dad really are having a tough time managing how they communicate around the kid and govern, so to speak, with the kid or children. And so a child specialist, their client is the child or children. And so there are privileged and confidential communications that take place in that sphere. They report to the team. So they essentially become an individual advocate for the child, but it's a short-term relationship. It's not their therapist. Okay. The child specialist is not the child's therapist and will obviously use the child's therapist as a resource to whatever extent that's possible. So a child specialist, you could think of it in the litigation side, you know, we have the custody evaluation and the custody evaluators. You could think of this as the neutral and focused on getting this child or children over a bad patch in their parents and their life, as opposed to the evaluative kind of let's make a report to the court approach of the custody evaluation. Mm-hmm. Does that answer your question?
Yeah, I think what I'm kind of curious about in hearing that is because what you described is sort of like a guardian ad litem, but perhaps not with so much the legal focus.
Correct.
And more geared towards, you know, listening to the kids, but not necessarily taking their word as the gospel.
Correct.
So what are they able to offer to the rest of the group, to the parties and the mediator and counsel from that perspective to help with resolving whatever the custody situation is going to look like?
Oh my goodness. They capture the goals and interests of the children.
Okay.
Right. So for my client, I'm capturing their goals and interests and advocating them. That child specialist is capturing the goals and interests of the child. You know, I want stability. I want to continue in this particular activity. I don't want to be around that boyfriend, girlfriend of mom or dad. I really hate my school. Can't we think about some other option. I don't like this tutor. Is there a different, you know, in other words, advocating the goals and interests of the child.
Okay. Probably what I'm struggling with on that point is it feels very much like what we run into just in traditional litigation, and that we are always trying to balance the difference between what a child might be saying versus sometimes the attitude of, well, we're not going to let the kids steer the ship. And then you probably put that over the layer of collaborative divorce or a mediation type of process. And can it be hard to, who ultimately, I guess, is concluding how this is going to play out?
That's the great thing. So this is a process where everyone is involved. Everyone has a voice, and there is not a decider. Okay. So if the family needs that, if they need a decider, if they need someone to kind of assess all the different points of view, strictly apply the law and render a decision, they're in the wrong process. Yeah. In fact, one of the cases for me that fell out of bed was where my client said, I want what I'm legally entitled to, right? That's a huge red flag that this is the wrong process for that person. And sure enough, that's what showed up. And,
well, that sounds like someone who any concession equals defeat.
Yeah, I would agree with that.
All right. That's good to know, because I mean, I think it always would feel to me, and again, this is somewhat of an outsider looking in of the process, that custody's got to be a difficult one to navigate. You know, certainly the other issues, being able to obtain appraisals and do business valuations and things like that. You know, it's not uncommon for us in the litigation world to try to find a neutral. Of course, oftentimes what ends up happening is you decide on a neutral, don't like that outcome, and you go hire your own anyway.
Exactly.
So maybe while we have the time still, you could tell us a little bit about what the process really looks like. I know when we talked in preparation of this, you talked about that you really develop a roadmap as to where it's going to go and how it's going to be handled. So why don't you talk about that?
Yes. So let's say we've got a relatively inexperienced team. We have a document called the roadmap. And so it tells us, okay, first thing is let's hire up the professionals for the team. And the clients determine that. I have a recent case with a lovely Montgomery County collaboratively trained attorney where the clients were very clear to us that they didn't think they needed a divorce coach. And as much as I love to have one, I can say after two of our full team meetings, I see that we probably didn't need a divorce coach for this family. So they're involved. We don't dictate to them who's going to be on the team. And you would think that having all these professionals getting hired would be expensive for the family. Well, clearly it is relative to mediation. Although as a mediator, I will often use a financial neutral. It's not the cheapest method and it's not the most expensive by any means, because in a litigated case, for instance, the example of the family business is that there are two business valuation experts at their full rates going. There are two attorneys that all the financials are funneling through. There are so many opportunities for big bills here. Whereas if we're in the collaborative process, we only have one business valuation, and the magic words at the end can be different than the magic words in the one that's presented to the court tribunal. So the professional could say, look, I could have done this whole other analysis and I could have spent a bunch more hours on it. Do you really want that? Because it doesn't have to be presented to a tribunal. So, you know, a lower bill there on professionals. And the communication envelope is so much more effective that some of us like four-way meetings. Some of us trained as litigators see how we can get a whole lot done in a four-way meeting, especially when we trust the emotional intelligence of our adversary, which I don't always trust them. But if I do, a four-way meeting, we get a lot done, right? So just think of this as a series of individual meetings, clients, lawyers, individual meetings, client, divorce coach, these highly effective full team meetings, and the structure of the agenda, the minutes, the homework, and the immediate knowing the schedule of the next meeting. The other thing that's great about it is let's imagine we're 12 time zones away from each other. Okay. One spouse is in Malaysia and the other spouse is here in Pennsylvania. That's a tough case to litigate. That just beats everybody up if we have to litigate that case. And it's very stressful. And if you're managing international custody issues as well, I recently was involved in a case that did involve, you know, like 12 time zones apart and did involve international custody application of law. And My goodness, I just can't tell you how smooth and very effective for everybody involved the process is.
It strikes me that very much this is a process which, for the people that avail themselves to it, it really can create a smooth, streamlined method for approaching the family law issues. And what I thought was also interesting is you talked a little bit about the expectations that sometimes people have or that sometimes reveal themselves in conversation. And you also talked about legal norms, like you kind of made a passing reference to that. And we talked a little bit more in detail about that offline. And I thought that was interesting because for those listening, you know, legal norms are the rule of thumb ideas that we oftentimes employ in our case. Cases, right, Peter? It's like sort of the 1 year of alimony for every 3 years of marriage and those types of things that can sometimes lock us into, I guess, a certain mentality as to how things ought to go. And what you're saying with this kind of process is you could be a little bit looser with those, or you could be a little bit less beholden to them. And is that an offshoot of really trying to analyze what the party's objectives are?
Exactly.
And how do you move them off of those legal norms? You know, because they've done their Google searches and they understand they're supposed to be receiving these things.
Right. So the legal norms is, as their advocate, it's really important for me to explain the legal norms, explain the law that applies to their facts, just so they have that as a reference point. We hold fast to their goals and interests, and the North Star of the collaborative divorce process is where they have shared goals and interests. And I've been in countless meetings where things start to bog down in the communication, and we'll nudge each other and we'll say, hey, I have it here that, you know, you share this goal. I have it here that, you know, you both want this for, you know, the one family member. And so we bring them back to, that's our North Star. What are their goals and interests? And so they're not fumbling around. They're not referring to this kind of artificial outside framework of the law that applies to any set of facts or the vagaries of county practice, right? So there are differences between our local counties. These people are less likely to get caught up in that.
Interesting. Okay. Just to wrap things up, what should we really take away when it comes to considering a collaborative divorce process? Or what is it that you really think people ought to know as they consider this as an option for their cases?
So first of all, I would say work-life balance, quality of life. This is so much better than litigation. This can stretch your life out an extra 5-10 years. I actually have a device that's called an Oura Ring, O-U-R-A, which measures different metrics in my body, and it measures daytime stress, okay? If I'm in a litigation setting, daytime stress is through the roof, okay? Which means that if I'm the horse, I got rode hard and put away wet. And if I've got the same kind of thing on my schedule tomorrow, I don't have a chance to recover properly, right? If I'm involved in collaborative divorces, my body's going to hold up better. I'm going to have a longer journey on planet Earth. And I'm so grateful to this being designed. That's one thing. Again, I mentioned the receivables. My colleagues and I, we just don't have receivables in these cases. I mentioned also controlling your calendar. So there's not an arbitrary thing showing up on my calendar from court administration or some judge's chambers. I'm in complete control of that. And we build a nice bond with our colleagues, okay? So lawyers by nature, I mean, we're competitive, we're didactic, we fasten on certain things like a dog on a bone, things like that. I mean, it's baked in, but I formed really close, nice working relationships with the professionals in our affiliated group. So work-life balance. I mean, I would say to my fellow family lawyers, work-life balance, this is something to really just take a class, take the training, dip your toe in. You don't have to sell the family farm and move into the city. You basically dip your toe in. That's all I did back in 2010. I dipped my toe in, and this is the stuff that keeps showing up for me to do.
Awesome. Thank you for educating us on this process and this style of practicing law. And where can we find you if we want to learn more about this?
We have a website called gocollaborativepa.com. Gocollaborativepa.com. That's our local Southeastern Pennsylvania group. We've also got an international group, and you can find them under www.collaborativepractice.com. It's amazing to me that I can be on a call with a guy in Switzerland, a gal in France, a guy in Japan, and we're all in the same pond. You know, we're all in this collaborative divorce pond. And I would also tell you that collaborative law applies in the estate area. So rather than some big nasty orphans court case, it could be a collaborative. It applies to prenuptial agreements. People get bruised sometimes by having two advocate lawyers for their prenup. This is a much smoother ride for that young couple or second marriage couple or whoever it might be.
That's great. Well, Peter, thank you for the time today, and we look forward to hearing more from you in the future.
Hey, thanks, Aaron. This is a great opportunity. Really appreciate it.
Thank you again to Peter Bort for joining us today, and thank you for listening to the Pennsylvania Bar Association's Law and the Family. Again, I'm Aaron Weems. If you have something to share, a topic you want to hear about, or if you'd like to keep this conversation going, please find me on Twitter or X, whatever you want to call it, at Aaron Weems, ATTY. And you can also find me on the Fox Rothschild website. Thanks again. We'll be back again soon with more ideas and concepts related to the Pennsylvania Family Lawyer.
Law and the Family is a production of the Pennsylvania Bar Association Family Law Section. To learn more or to join the section, visit the Pennsylvania Bar Association website at pabar.org. And be sure to follow us on Facebook, LinkedIn, and Twitter. And to catch up on every episode, join us at anchor.fm/lawinthefamily. A reminder that nothing in this podcast should be taken as legal advice for any individual case or situation. This information is not intended to create an attorney-client relationship. The opinions expressed are those of the hosts and the guests and don't necessarily represent those of the Pennsylvania Bar Association. Thanks for listening and tune in for future podcasts.